From Austin Film Festival, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. On Story features discussions with a diverse array of voices who use the language of film and television to tell a story. All of our content is recorded live at the Austin Film Festival and Conference, at our year-round events, and in up-to-the-minute interviews. On this week's podcast, Everybody Loves Raymond executive producer and Somebody Feed Phil creator and host Phil Rosenthal will discuss the common thread between travel shows and sitcoms, the unifying power of food, and the late, great Anthony Bourdain.
For me, I have found that food is the great connector.
And later, Rosenthal discusses his comedy documentary, Exporting Raymond. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. In 1995, Phil Rosenthal created the hit CBS comedy Everybody Loves Raymond. He served as showrunner and executive producer for all 9 years of the series' run, which earned more than 70 Emmy nominations. Rosenthal's new Netflix series, Somebody Feed Phil, follows Phil as he travels the globe, taking in the local cuisine and culture. I sat down with Phil to discuss food, family, and the new season of Somebody Feed Phil, which is out July 6th on Netflix. Clips of Somebody Feed Phil, courtesy of Netflix, Inc.
The best brownie.
The best steak in the world.
The best pizza.
One of the best hot dogs you ever had.
I'm not kidding.
Best chocolate egg cream.
Yes!
When you just travel and you get to meet great people.
Buongiorno!
This is like a paradise.
To see you dancing the tango.
You danced a little bit clutchy.
No, he didn't. I don't agree with him.
Okay, because she's not a good dancer.
Talk first about your show, Somebody Feed Phil, and how your central theme in this is really not just about food and not just about travel, but about family and sort of communing with the world on your travels. So,
I'm so glad you get it.
For me and for, you know, my daughter and I have become entranced with the show. And
yeah.
I think the reason is because in your travels, we really feel like we're traveling with you. It's really getting to learn about, you know, what the people eat and how they live. And so I'd love you to talk about how, in a big sense, family seems to fit into everything you do from Everybody Loves Raymond through Somebody Feed Phil.
Yes, you're right. It does factor in. I never really think about it like that, but I guess it's just inherent in who I am and what I care about. You know, family, it's a microcosm of the world to me. And now I'm really in the world, and I'm finding that we're all a family. Mm. I think it's as simple as that. You go, and the differences in people are obvious, but then what I learned, the biggest lesson is we're all the same.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take a genius to figure it out. We all like to live in a nice place. We want to be friends. We want our children to be well and maybe even surpass us.
Mm-hmm.
We want them to have clean air and water and have a good education and get a good job and be happy. All people are the same. It's the narrow-minded that try to keep people away, thinking that they're different because of fear or whatever. Yeah, my big slogan today is, instead of a wall, how about a table? I feel like if those boys from ISIS would just sit down and have some chocolate cake with me, everything would be okay.
Well, you do seem to love chocolate, but your relationship to food is clearly from this show, big and rich and deep and very emotional.
Yes.
And that comes through in Somebody Feed Phil. So what was the dinner table like at your house growing up?
That's hilarious that you'd ask that because that's like wasn't so good. And maybe it's because it wasn't so good. You know, my mom worked, my dad worked. They didn't have really time or money to spend on the meal. And so it was kind of almost an afterthought, something to get through. it's not like we had the distractions of the phone or anything else. I mean, we were there and we did have that family time, so that was important. And there were either big laughs or big fights. That was my family. But the food was kind of secondary. It wasn't very good. We joked that my mom had a setting on the oven for shoe. I said in the opening credits of the last thing, it was like meat was a punishment. Dry steak, cooked beyond recognition, hurt your jaws if you were a little kid like me to chew. I didn't know what steak was. I was in my 20s when somebody said, hey, you want to go to a steakhouse? Why would anybody want to go to a steakhouse? I thought, that can't be good. Until I went to, I think it was Gallagher's in Midtown Manhattan, and this beautiful thing came out sizzling, and it was gorgeous, you know, thick and beautiful and cut, and it's red inside, not gray. That's steak? Can I taste? Yeah, that's why we're here. Okay. Boom. Right? These are the epiphanies for me. I never had garlic until I left my mom's house.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
So when, you know, when if you're the right age, if you're a teenager or in your early 20s and you and that music of that time, that becomes your music for the rest of your life. That's my stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Food's like that for me. I've spoken to great chefs like Alice Waters, who said that her mom was a terrible cook. And it wasn't until she went to Europe and discovered the flavor of vegetables that weren't in a can, right? Mm-hmm. Came back, changed American cooking. Yeah, these things hit us at the right moment in our lives when we're open and ready for them, mm-hmm. and like them and want them. That's what happened to me. And so I became obsessed with this. And it has always been, for me, I have found that food is the great connector. When we sit and eat, right? Mm-hmm. First of all, we're not killing each other because we're eating. And we like to eat. Everybody has to, first of all. Second of all, it could be the only break in our day that's nice if we're working hard, right? Mm-hmm. And then so I found food is the great connector, and laughs then for me are the cement. Like if we share a laugh together, now we're friends. So food and laughs and at this good times have always gone together. And I found on Raymond, for instance, that if I provided great food at the craft service table, just where the crew goes during a slow moment in the day to get the chips or, you know, nuts or whatever crap is usually on that thing. Well, what if we put great food there? You know what happens? You build a family. Getting back to family, I find that food makes a family. That's where the family lives. Every sitcom, every show about a family has a kitchen set because that's where the family is a family.
It's interesting that you have now brought your whole family into this project, and still one of my favorite documentaries that we've ever showed in 25 years, Exporting Raymond, which was your documentary about taking Everybody Loves Raymond to Russia.
To make Everybody Loves Kostya.
Which was hysterical. And it was this introduction to your parents in here.
Yep.
That was one of the things I found so wonderful and charming and such a great addition to the documentary. And now these people are in your show and you're sharing.
Every show.
I will tell you, that's one of the favorite parts, my daughter's favorite parts.
Oh, I know.
To see your parents.
Oh, they're the stars. Mm-hmm. I hear from people, we like the show. We love your parents. Mm-hmm. So I say, why do I bother traveling? I could sit in the kitchen with them, save everybody a lot of time and money.
But it's so funny, though, that you're sharing this food experience with your parents that was so different than when you grew up.
Absolutely. So. I say, hey, Mom, you want to see what I ate today? Not really. They don't really care about that stuff. But I want to show them anyway. This is what food is, Ma. Look, this is good.
Hello?
Can you see us? These are my parents in New York.
Get a chair.
Do I accept?
Yes. Accept. Mm-hmm. Here we are. Okay.
Ah,
okay. This is Vladimir and Ludmila. This is Max and Helen.
This technology is amazing. And then my dad hits the wrong button and they don't think we can see them anymore.
I knew it. Max, I said,
are you okay?
To not to touch anything.
They get it now. Listen, in that documentary, that scene was accidental. That scene was I was with this Russian family, and the grandparents seemed to be tech savvy. They knew how the computer worked. I said, that's not like my parents. Do you know how to Skype? Oh, yeah, sure. let's Skype with my parents. Just like that. Mm-hmm. And they happen to be up. You know, I got lucky. You saw that was the hit of the movie. Biggest laughs. So I'm not stupid. I thought, I'm going to put them in the show. First of all, the Skype home is the modern equivalent of the postcard. So why not have that? It ties it all together. It reinforces the theme of the show. Mm-hmm. You hit it right away. Family. Right? So I'm echoing that we're all family. Look, parents, we all have it. It's relatable. Mm-hmm. But secondly, they always deliver. They're always funny. Mm-hmm. You turn the camera on them, something funny. My father is this repository of all the old Jewish jokes in the world, mm-hmm. and he has them at the ready. It doesn't matter what the subject is. He's got a joke. My favorite is, I haven't talked to your mother in 35 years. I don't want to interrupt.
Well, one of the things that also I find so wonderful about this new show is again, you're taking us on travels to these cities that most people haven't had an opportunity to go to really experience the food on a number of different levels. I love that you have a lot of street food, you know, communal food, the things that everybody eats, but also the choices that you've made with the restaurants you've chosen. For instance, in New Orleans, to have an Israeli restaurant be a featured restaurant where everybody's talking about red beans and rice, these people do too. But I'd love to hear how you choose the places that you are featuring in the show.
Well, when I heard that the number one rated restaurant in New Orleans was this Israeli restaurant, Shaya, I was like, well, that's interesting. Let's check that out. I had no idea how really good it was going to be, how authentic it was going to be. It's fantastic. It's fantastic. That's interesting to me. Yes, we're going to show the red beans and rice. We're going to show the gumbo. We're going to show the everything that New Orleans is famous for. But isn't it interesting to shake it up a little too? Mm-hmm. And to show how the world is kind of great because of this mashup of culture and diversity? Mm-hmm. In that same episode, I quote Will Smith, the actor who I got to talk to. I don't know if this is his line or not, but he said this to me. Diversity is America's superpower. I never thought of it that way. Not only is it not a bad thing, it's actually the best thing about our country. Mm-hmm. And so that's to be celebrated. So I'm looking for that.
Yeah.
I'm always looking for that because I think that's what makes life grand.
Well, so the places you went to in this first season with your show on Netflix are really incredibly broad. Bangkok, Tel Aviv, New Orleans. And each episode is a single place. So it's six places you got to go to that first season. Can you talk to us a little bit about where we're going to see you go when your new season starts on July 6th with Netflix?
Copenhagen, Dublin, Venice, Italy, Cape Town, South Africa, Buenos Aires, and New York, which is very personal to me because I lived there the whole first half of my life. I'm a New Yorker. My parents are in New York. We go to what I call the birthplace of the blues, my mother's kitchen, and we have a scene there. I think people will like that one especially.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. We'll be back in a moment.
Thank you.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with Somebody Feed Phil creator and host, Phil Rosenthal. When we left off, Rosenthal was discussing how food played an important role in meeting his wife, actress Monica Horan. So when are we going to get to see Monica in the show?
Yeah, Monica. So Monica, like the first six, she was doing other things. She wasn't really available. But I think you'll see her in three of these six now. You'll see the kids, too, a little bit. I don't want to be too indulgent, so I try to not overdo it. But people seem to like Monica a lot. I think they like her more than me. I better be careful. I think they'll give the show to her and kick me out. She's so charming and great, and our whole meeting and everything, our courtship, every romance happened in New York. So that show's very personal and special to me.
And how much over food was that?
Oh, everything. I met her at the 9th Avenue Food Fair. Mm-hmm. I had seen her in a play done by mutual friends of ours, but I'd never met her. And she was really funny. And I was too shy to stay and tell her that. So I said to our mutual friends, tell that girl, she's funny. And then I kind of forgot about her. And a week later, I'm walking at the 9th Avenue Food Fair. Both sides of the street are lined with street food vendors. It's fantastic. So I'm walking with a giant beef rib in my hand, and I'm dripping on myself. This is 1986. And up the street comes this girl with one of our mutual friends. Mm-hmm. And I look at her, and oh, hi, I'm a big fan of yours. And she says, I'm a big fan of yours, too. She told me later, that was a complete lie. Mm-hmm. The whole thing is built on a lie, Barbara. She lied to me. Maybe she wanted the rib in my hand. I don't know what it was, but it's all a lie.
And how long have you been married now?
28 and a half years.
Well, she gets spoken about a lot in the first season, so I think we're very anxious to see her involved in
your
travels.
She's a big part of my life.
We watch a lot of cooking shows. My daughter loves cooking shows. I will say I have not watched any cooking show with her that made me as hungry as Somebody Feed Phil.
Wow.
And I think it's the way you shoot the food and your eating of the food. And, of course, I have seen nothing yet that you didn't really care for. Maybe one
There's
or
one
two
or
things.
Two things. Yeah. The show's not about that, mm-hmm. right? It's not about eating the gross stuff. Mm-hmm. There are shows like that. Not interested. There's a goal. The goal is to get you to travel. Mm-hmm. I think the world would be better if we all could experience a bit of someone else's experience. So the food is just the way in. Mm-hmm. You know, it's this. The show's really about human connection and family, disguised as a food and travel show with humor, hopefully. Mm-hmm. But we don't overdo it, meaning we don't stop the action. If you and I are in a restaurant in Bangkok, we're not stopping our conversation to get the inserts of the food shots. That's secondary. I do want you to know what I love about it. Mm-hmm. You see the detail of it, mm-hmm. because it's all in the details, as we know. You get it, hopefully, from seeing it a little and then our reaction to it.
Mm-hmm. Your facial expressions when you are eating, and I think they're most expressive with sugary things.
Is that true?
Maybe it's just our reaction to your sugary things because you pick some really good ones. But
yeah.
I loved when you were in Tel Aviv and you went to that bakery where the guys were wearing the T-shirts.
And it was Jews and Arabs working there for over 100 years in the family.
But their donut looked great.
It was great. It was great. But look what happens when we work together. Make a great donut.
And that was in the pastiche in Lisbon? Is that how you pronounce it?
Pastel is if you're having one. Pastiche is if you're having as many as I had.
Well, it was a lot. One of the things you were telling me earlier, and I think this is interesting, is you're saying that Israeli food is a new hot thing, and we'll be seeing it around the rest of the country.
Now, after dinner at Alan's house, I just had to experience the number one restaurant in New Orleans. Yes, it's an Israeli restaurant. This is Shaya.
Oh, ho, ho.
Hey, Phil.
Hi, buddy.
I've missed you.
I miss you, too.
I haven't seen you in a few days.
I'm happy to be here. Look at that.
Come see. Come around. It's an Italian pizza oven.
Yeah.
We've pretty much just repurposed it to make pita bread.
This guy's a brilliant chef, James Beard Award-winning chef.
what he chooses to do in that restaurant is man that pita oven.
Can you talk a little bit about the things that you've discovered with, especially being Jewish, like food you never ate when you were growing up that you discovered now with, especially when you went to Tel Aviv?
Well, what we think of as Jewish food is kind of old Eastern European food, right? The food of Israel is actually an amalgam of all the food around Israel from the Middle East. Falafel and hummus and baba ganoush, you know, the eggplant dip, and then the fresh baked pita bread and shawarma. You know, what's interesting is that rotating spit that they carve off vertically, right? That vertical spit. Mm-hmm. In Mexico, I'm having the pork carved that way. It turns out that the reason that exists in Mexico is because people came from the Middle East, but they had pork in Mexico, so they put pork on it.
Yeah. Now I want to talk about the thing that I'm desperate to eat from one of your shows, which was Bangkok.
Oh.
There was this crazy fried omelet with a lady who wore goggles. So can you talk about how you found that and what it was that you were eating? Because this is something, I guess, how you have to go to Bangkok to get it.
This is J-Fi's crab omelet.
Oh, that's a lot of crab.
That's a lot of crab.
Come on. I think I'm in love.
That's a huge amount of crab. I think it has the meat of two or three crabs.
I have never been so interested in the cooking of anything in my life.
If they submerge it. Fantastic, look at that.
She's like a pilot.
It's incredible. Ah, so she's pouring more egg on it, on the outside.
More egg.
So it's as it's cooking on the underside, she's putting more raw egg on the top to insulate it and make it moist. A Thai word you have to learn if you're doing that food, hom.
Hom means?
Which means it smells good.
It sure does. Hom.
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 Hom. And at the end of the day, what you get is a, basically a football filled with crab. Look at that.
That is a crab moment.
So she's 73 years old. She's been doing this her whole life. It's a wok over real wood coals, super hot. Oil in it, puts eggs in it. They start cooking up fast. And then she dumps, I think, a pound and a half of freshly shucked crab meat into there. And then starts with a ladle, turning it, so that the egg forms a little seal around the crab, and then keeps ladling fresh egg over that and turning it, so layers upon layers and layers upon layers seamlessly form this egg cocoon over this football filled with crab by the time she's done. By the way, she's transferring it from the really hot wok to the less hot wok. That's how she regulates temperature and evenness of cooking. It was fascinating to watch. You can see the whole process. It takes just a couple of minutes. We condensed it to a couple of minutes. But you can see it's one of the most fascinating dishes. How did we find it? She's world famous. She's famous. That's the most famous street food in Bangkok. There's a big line. It's very expensive for street food, where most things are 50 cents or a dollar at the most. This crab omelet is $30. Now, why is it $30? Because in America, it would be $150 because of the labor. Because of the freshness of the crab, the time it takes to shuck it and, you know, pick out all the meat. Easily, you share it for two, three people. One of the best things you ever ate. 2 months after we filmed, she won a Michelin star for street food.
Wow.
I think it was the first street food to ever win a Michelin star. Oh. 4 months after that, she called the Michelin people and said, take the star back. There's too many people.
Wow.
Yeah.
The thing I think that was so astounding about watching that wasn't just that, oh, this is an amazing thing, we'll never get to get this here. It was the artistry of her making it.
That's right.
That I thought was so beautiful, and what you were presenting to us and then talking about and then meeting her.
Oh,
and so it's just really such a connection as a viewer that you actually get with your show, which I think is so
astounding. And she's so cute. She's got the goggles, like you said, because to protect her from the smoke of the wok, she looks like Snoopy going off to fight the Red Baron, I say. She's so adorable, and she loves people. To give you a hug, you know? That's everything to me.
Are there any misadventures we didn't get to see?
Sometimes something goes so amiss that it's funny. And so we'll put that in, because we are trying to get some laughs, too. In I'll Have What Phil's Having, the first series that was for PBS, but Netflix now carries as well. It's exactly the same show. it's just, you know, now we're shooting on 4K cameras for Netflix. I have a theme song I'm very delighted about. But there was a scene there in Hong Kong where I tried a 1,000-year-old egg. It's not really 1,000. It just tastes that way. The yolk of the egg is a bluish green, and the white is like a orange brown. It's a preserved egg. It's buried in the ground with lime and ash, and it's preserved, and this is a delicacy. I didn't realize that you're supposed to take a tiny sliver of this thing and put it in a hot pot with many, many other ingredients. So these, you know, hard-boiled eggs cut in half were sitting out on this table at the hot pot restaurant. One woman I was with was saying, I'm not tasting that. And I said, oh, come on. And I picked up the entire half an egg and popped it in my mouth. The first thing you hear on the soundtrack is my brother laughing off camera because I think my face turned the colors of the egg. And the bravest thing I think I've ever done is chew and swallow that thing. But the first thing you taste is really, really rotten egg. And the next thing you taste is an overpowering wave of ammonia. I'm born without a poker face, right? I can't hide it if I want to. And if things are just okay, why bother putting them in? Again, I'm trying to get you to come here. So I'm trying to entice you with the best stuff. Why show you the bad stuff? There's enough bad stuff, right?
Huge question begs to be asked. Why are you not fat?
I have to work hard at not being. I have to, you know, I don't want people to think I'm just the lucky guy. As I get older, especially, the metabolism slows down and I have to be careful. By the way, you know how they make a dog food commercial? They starve the dog before the commercial. So the dog looks excited when he's eating the dog food. I'm the dog. So I don't eat really before you see me on camera. You're seeing me in an hour eat everything I ate in 10 days. I'm usually having one or two meals a day. But off camera, I'm not really eating. And by the way, everything you see me eating on that show, I'm sharing with the rest of the crew because they're all looking at me with their tongues hanging out. So I'd be cruel not to give them at least half of what I'm eating. Mm. Unless something's one bite. Sorry, everybody. Got to do it. And then I work out every day. I have to. Don't you know when you travel, do you find this? You walk way more than you do at home?
Yeah,
you want to see everything. So the exercise happens without you even realizing it. That's a great way, by the way, to stay slim is to get out there. If you sit home, you'll get fat.
So my last big question for you is, what is the most, I think, outstanding thing you've discovered on these journeys? You know, I'm sure you've had lots of travel in your life, but now that you're traveling with such focus for the show and where you're really, truly experiencing each place that you go, what have you found from these travels?
I would watch Anthony Bourdain, rest in peace, the biggest influence on me in this line of work, right? And probably everyone who followed him. And I would live vicariously through him. I would watch him and say, he's amazing. I'm never doing that. Yeah, I can't do it. He's like a superhero to me. My point is to show you that if that guy can go outside, maybe I can too. So many of us don't have a passport. Even 2/3 of Americans don't even have a passport. And that's including everyone who came to America with a passport. I'm here to say, look, I'm starting with Earth's greatest hits, the most accessible places where almost everybody speaks English. Number one, you're going to have a hotel. You don't have to worry, is what I'm saying. I think all of us are afraid. Well, what's going to be there for me? Well, I'm used to this and this and this. Yes, you'll find the comforts of home almost anywhere that we're going. And I want to show you that the world is not so scary that you don't have to be afraid. That's the big takeaway. I'm afraid too. Listen, they tell me we're going to do this, this. I said, no, that's not me. And sure enough, every time I take that little baby step out of my comfort zone, that's been the biggest discovery. That's been the best part. They say the reason you travel is the journey inward, the stuff you learn about yourself. By the way, you're going to see in the Buenos Aires episode, I take a tango lesson. Of everything I've done, that was the scariest thing I've ever done. Because that's humiliating. I have no coordination. I'm with a professional. I'm embarrassing myself in front of this nice lady. It was agonizing. And then it wasn't.
It feels like you're throwing yourself out of your comfort zone sometimes.
That's the key.
And is that something that you, I mean, have you found yourself truly enjoying doing that experience?
Yes. And it's funny, though, because you always think the line keeps moving. Like, okay, that I did that, but I'm not doing this. And then I do this.
Mm-hmm.
So Before you know it, maybe I'll be as adventurous as Anthony Bourdain was.
Maybe.
Who knows? Look what happened to him. He was a chef, right? And then he became this adventurer, and then he became a world-class journalist, a serious journalist. His show was the number one show on CNN. I'm nowhere near at that level. I'm enjoying the food and the people. That's it. But that's enough for me right now. You know, in my little baby steps, you know, out of my comfort zone, are all I'm asking the audience to do too. I'm not satisfied with you just watching and feeling like you're there with me. I actually want you to get up and go, because it's not the same. The life-changing part is when you go. By the way, you're never going to be as young as you are right now. So while everything's still working, everybody, go.
I'd love to hear your answer to it, because you actually asked the question, but you didn't answer it.
Oh.
And that is, how does a place get its hooks in you?
I guess it's what your values are. If you fall in love with the way the place looks, the way it feels, the food, I think, is an element for me, the ease of how you can get around. There's also this otherworldly thing. I don't know anything about past lives, right? But maybe there's something that you feel like, why do we feel really comfortable in certain places and not others? Certain places speak to us. Have we been here before? Who knows? I can't even explain it. But of course, it's the friends you make. That's the bottom line. The people are always going to be the deciding factor for me in how much I love a place. I'm lucky because everywhere I've been, I've made friends. Mm-hmm. The best part of my job are the friends I've made. I'm going back to Lisbon next week to visit the people I met on the show. That's the greatest.
Following the creation of the hit CBS comedy Everybody Loves Raymond, Rosenthal is asked to adapt the series for Russian television. He chronicles this journey through the comedy documentary Exporting Raymond. The film follows Phil as he travels to Moscow to recreate the show for Russian audiences as Everybody Loves Kostya. Throughout the film, Rosenthal faces a series of challenges. Eventually, he and the Russian creators come to an understanding despite the obvious culture and language barriers. The documentary premiered at the Austin Film Festival in 2010. Rosenthal spoke with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang writer-director Shane Black at the Paramount Theater after the screening. Clips of Exporting Raymond, courtesy of Samuel Goldwyn Films and Sony Pictures Home Entertainment.
It's time to meet the head of comedy for the Russian network. We meet him, and he doesn't look like a head of comedy.
And he gets around to saying, when I read Raymond,
this is not funny.
I don't have to come to Moscow to be told I'm not funny. I could hear that in my house.
You're a musician too?
I play on animals, yes.
You play on animals?
Enemy, you know?
Enemy.
Animals.
You play enema bags?
Yeah.
And this is my director.
Sit down.
I will. Shane Black, everybody.
Wow, so Phil is one of my neighbors in Los Angeles. I've never been to his house. I barely know him. But imagine me watching this movie, realizing for the first time what a singular individual lived three doors away.
Oh, you could have had all this time.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI, we'll be back in a moment.
Thank you.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with Exporting Raymond writer-director Phil Rosenthal. When we left off, Rosenthal was discussing the pitfalls of the Russian production, including casting and what was left on the cutting room floor.
You're talking about what seems to be the universal language, which is, you know, comedy. You would think that the Honeymooners would instantly be understood.
Yes.
Your translator seems to get it, right?
Right.
The girl, she knows you're funny and she laughs at your jokes.
Yes, yes, she should have been in the show. No, I loved her. I mean, it just shows you, yeah, you can't generalize.
Right.
It's not all Russians, it's individual people.
Well, the funniest thing to me was the head of comedy.
Head of comedy. Yes.
What I took away from this thing was that more than being about family or this or that, the film is about you being the diplomat, the need for diplomacy, and something as fragile as comedy. My God, how excruciating is it?
Very, very. I'm sure that you have had this experience, and you didn't have to go to another country to get it. I mean, I think that's the point I was trying to make, is that, oh, aren't they? And then I come home, and it's here too. I mean, really, I can show you heads of comedy that are just as, yes, severe. I want to tell them one line that I cut. For political reasons, I was very angry at that man when he told me that my show wasn't funny. I thought that wasn't nice. And so in the car ride, when I was doing the little recap of what had happened at that dinner, I said to the camera, he looked like someone out of Schindler's List, and not the list part.
It's a wonderful movie.
Thank you, sir.
In getting to this point, I'm sure there's a room full of writers, I expect, or a lot of would-be or perhaps even produced writers. They're going through something that you went through a long time ago before you were produced, which is they have to deal with people mangling their stuff and they don't have an angle on it. They don't have, yes, any leverage with which to combat that.
Right.
At an early stage, tell them a little bit, if you can, about what it takes to be a diplomat when someone is just not getting something that you know is funny.
You draw a line. You have to, and I'm sure you've done this too. You have to say, this is as far as I'm willing to compromise, and now I feel it's hurting the show, or the movie, or the poem, right, or the haiku. It's all like the advice I got from the man who you bought your house from, Ed Weinberger. He was a great television producer, and he said those words, do the show you want to do, because in the end, they're going to cancel you anyway. That's true. That's a lesson of life. We all get canceled. Live your life, right? So that applies to any art form that you're working in. You have to, you know, take that stand. You let them mangle a little, but when they start to really hurt it, you can't. Otherwise, why do it?
So you had the experience, too, of somewhat choosing actors. What are the qualities when you look at something that spark you? What's the thing in an actor that most excites you, makes you want to use that person?
It's funny, you know, like watching these people, people were asking me as it was going on, how do you know who's funny? You don't speak the language, but somehow you know. It's like when you go to a foreign movie and you see like Roberto Benigni. We all know he's funny, funnier than the guy standing next to. It's just something that comes across, and you know someone who's a great actor without being funny, you know, that someone who can move you. I think there's a humanity in all of us, and we see it in the eyes, and we see it in the expression, and we feel it. And that is universal. Sometimes it's people deny it or want to deny it or say that's not. You know, one of the problems in Russia was they were saying, why would we make it like real life? We live real life every day. That's not funny. Right?
And then they might have a point, you know.
They might have a point, but then when they do this broad kind of sketchy stuff, I noticed they weren't laughing. And when something hit them that they related to as a human being, not a Russian, not an American, they laughed.
Well, this is what impressed me the most, was that you came into this with people saying, start doubting, Phil, because obviously Russian sensibilities are
totally different.
Yeah. Totally, they're not going to like this. They're just, right. And then it's the number one show. So the idea of persistence then,
yes,
really paying off.
Glad you got that out of it, because what I got out of it is after I left, they did whatever the hell they want and made it a big hit. For this, I went twice.
How many times were you on the set of Raymond where you let me in front of that camera? I mean, you're a natural actor.
Oh, thanks.
Don't you think?
I think I should be. Thank you. Very nice. Tell him, because I really want to be an action hero. I think Shane is tired of the usual strong, muscular, handsome people. I think you're ready to go the other way, man.
I already had a gay protagonist.
You did?
Yeah.
I can do that. Anything for a part.
You know, do people in Russia see that this is somehow a revolutionary shift in the sort of comedy they're used to? Do they recognize the difference?
I'd like to think that's why it's now the number one show. Because suddenly they go, oh, this is something that I really relate to. That's what I'd like to think. But I'll tell you something, that I watch the shows on the internet. They send them to me. And early on, they sent me an episode where in the middle of the episode, sexy nurse walks in, like out of laughing, and I called them. I said, what the hell is that? We never had that in the show. I said, oh, Russians like that. So it was still a battle. It was still, you know, trying to get them to come around to it.
Where was it on a scale of 1 to 10?
The Russian version?
Yeah.
2. No. A 10 for them, right? It's not for us. It's not for me. That's the thing you had to get through the thick head, right? It's like your kids, you gotta let them eventually go. To me, there's a fundamental problem with the Russian version, still, and that is Raymond. I wouldn't cast that guy. I just wouldn't.
The table read proceeds, and for the most part, our actors fit the roles pretty well.
They все время обманывали меня. Вы не покупали мне жвачку и говорили, что ее варят цыгане.
Нужно научиться говорить ребенку нет. Купи этот учебник. Нет.
All the actors get laughs, except for Кузькин.
До пяти утра.
Захотел ее поцеловать.
Не буди ее. Она поцеловала меня, чтобы я поцеловал тебя. Она поцеловала тебя через... На.
Ты прав.
Ну, давай, сейчас снова.
He is the lead in the show. He has to carry the ball. This could just be a subjective reaction. But I don't see anyone else laughing either, Russian or American.
Okay.
So I would be concerned if it was my pilot.
They now changed the name from Everybody Loves Kostya to the Voronins. Now, why did they do that? Because I don't think Raymond could carry the show. So they made it about the whole family and sold it that way. So they made it work for them. But I prefer a funny Raymond. That just me.
Are there cultural differences? Like you see a Arab TV and there's a comedy show where a guy walks up, puts a briefcase next to you and runs away as fast as he can. And I said, oh, that's funny.
Or the Japanese shows where the guy's sleeping, have you seen this? And they wheel a cannon into the bedroom and set it off. And then they laugh.
I mean, is it just that certain cultures are more fundamentally cruel? Feelings?
Yes. A lot of sick
Poland gonna happen.
Poland, Egypt, Holland. So far, there's lots of countries falling. I see all. I'm not going.
What was your first experience with getting in?
With getting in. When I started in New York, I was an actor, and I couldn't really get hired, and I ate tuna fish for dinner and every night, and now that I'm a writer, I eat whatever I want. Writer's just like one hair above acting, right? But some friends of mine and I wrote a show for ourselves to be in, which was a good idea, and that turned into Tony and Tina's Wedding. Yes. I don't see a dime from that, by the way. No. So if it's okay, I'd like to spend the rest of the evening complaining about that. But that was my transition into writing. And then, you know, I found a partner who was also out of work, and we put our heads together. That's a very good way to do it, you know, because if you write with a partner, you're the bargain. They pay you one price for two people. And they like that, and that's a way that you might be able to get in.
It also makes things go a little quicker, and it's less lonely. And even if you're sinking, it's nice to drown with someone, you know?
Exactly right. Exactly.
Absolutely. Let's ask Phil whatever you want to know about him or about the project. Just ask. Go ahead. In the audience, I'll pick.
Have any of the Russians seen this film?
Yes. Some saw a very early version. A couple of them were offended. I honestly didn't know why. A guy who was offended was the Russian producer, that really funny guy who said, "My wife is not in charge. Could you cut that from the film?" I thought it came off fantastically well. Well, I don't know what it is. It might have been just that thing of seeing yourself on the screen and hating yourself. But he hated it. The company, Sony, got very nervous that, oh no, the Russians don't like it. I got this note. Please cut all moments of humor and conflict with the Russians out of the film.
This is, I'll make a confession, but Everyone Loves Raymond was my mother and father's favorite show.
Oh, thanks.
I never seen an episode.
Really?
Not one, and now I will go see them.
I hope you do, because your parents need to talk to you about something. You want to connect on some level, right?
Let's have a couple more questions. And there's a lady over there.
How many hours of film? I'm going to say 180 something. Is that right, John? About. Can I introduce, because the whole crew is here. They all flew in from New York. Just stand up. Stand up. Where are my boys? You know, you're alone there otherwise, and you have these great fellas.
Oh, that's just, yeah, it seemed miserable cold, right? Down snow and rain all the time.
I went in March, and that was miserable. And then, because it wasn't quite miserable enough, they had me go back in December.
Another question?
Since everybody loves vodka, what's your favorite Russian vodka now?
Russian Standard Platinum. Very smooth.
Gentleman over there.
How's Eldar?
You know, he's great. People ask me what was the real story. And honestly, it's a Russian mystery. I really don't know. One theory was he told me the truth, right? And he had to tell them he was going on vacation because if they thought he was ill, he might lose his job. So I like to think that, so that's what I think. Yes?
They never thought of dubbing Everybody Loves Raymond instead of again.
Why didn't they just dub it instead of doing it their way? I don't know. We're in 140 countries that way, dubbed or subtitled. But you know, why did they feel the need to do The Office, which is in English?
Gentleman over in the middle there.
Where did you get the idea to make this into a film? Like, where did that start?
Michael Linton, the head of Sony, who you saw at the beginning, called me in his office, and I went in and he said, "We created the sitcom in Russia. It never existed before. Like 4 years ago, we brought the nanny over, they translated it, became a giant hit. But the people, they never made a sitcom before. They came from all walks of life, like Mr. Laser."
I'm a big fan of yours because they showed me The Nanny.
I just tried to get any, to introduce my experience into any new product. I like very much remembering.
And he just starts talking. And talking and talking about his philosophy of comedy and where he came from and how fascinating his life has been.
Like laser and such kind of things. He made special lasers in a special volume and scope.
There were many times working in television that I wish I knew about lasers. And I wish I had some with me.
Right? And the characters, he said, are so funny. How would you like to go over there and observe how we do it and come back and write a feature fictional comedy about a guy who goes over there with his show?
That's a step too many.
Well, that's what I said. I said, oh, that's funny, but if this situation and the people really exist, why not make a documentary? And he said, oh, I love that idea. Would you be the guy? And like an idiot, I said yes.
I applaud you for this wonderful movie. You made me laugh. You made everybody here laugh.
Thank you so much.
Your spirits in the film, oh, even. They're just, you're such a... I want to cast you. I want to use you.
This, Monica, you heard, my wife is listening to you, and she lives close by, so you don't make promises you can't keep.
I will not, if I was to knock on your door, I'll watch your show, Raymond. Thank you. Thanks, everybody. You made me feel good.
This is Barbara Morgan, host of On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. Tune in to your local public radio station for a look inside the creative process behind your favorite films and TV shows. Later this season, On Story will celebrate the 40th anniversary of Animal House and deconstruct the iconic comedy classic with Beverly Hills Cop writer Daniel Petrie Jr. and Role Models writer Timothy Dowling. Here's a quick preview of that episode.
Animal House. I'm a child of the 80s, and so I watched this movie in college, and I kind of feel like it's standard viewing for most people who decide to go to college. It kind of ends up being a little bit of a blueprint for how you decide to conduct yourself in college, maybe fortunately or unfortunately. But I had an interest. Much has been written about the film because it's considered widely as a very classic comedy, and often I've seen it actually called one of the best comedies ever made as well. So we know it's in the National Film Registry as well, so there's a copy at the Library of Congress. It's that culturally significant. So I was curious upon both of your first viewings, like, kind of how did it strike you the first time you watched this movie?
Well, first of all, became a fan right away. I enjoyed the movie, but I also had a sense, as somebody who was interested in being a writer someday and had ambitions toward comedy specifically, that I felt I was in the presence of a game changer taking place, that from now on, film comedy is not going to be quite the same as it was, that another sensibility, another generational shift has taken place.
I don't remember the first time that I saw it. I mean, I was too young when it came out to see it in the theater, but I remember watching it on TV and I loved this movie. But I think in thinking about this, kind of what Dan said is right, is I feel like this movie really was the birth of modern comedy. If you look at Caddyshack and Stripes and, the movie I did, Role Models, definitely, we're trying to have the same spirit of this. And, Wedding Crashers and The Hangover, like, they all sort of came from Animal House. And, I think in other ways too, like, if you look at the comedies that came before, like, it really just launched this sensibility. And, I think this movie also created the idea of a comic set piece, which hadn't really existed in movies Yes. before. So, anyway, it's a great film. It'll be fun to talk about.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan, as well as our associate producers, Aaron Halligan, Colin Heyer, Sonia Onescu, Maya Perez, and Brian Ramos. Our production coordinator is Ava Mikes. Editing help from Jamal Knox. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance, KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and Conference in October.
PRI, Public Radio International.